There was something else Tom needed to tell them, something important but subtle, and he was searching for the right words. Monks could be arrogant and might alienate the volunteers. Tom wanted today's operation to be easygoing and cheerful. "I've worked with volunteers before," he began. "It's important not to treat them like servants. We may feel that they are laboring to obtain a heavenly reward, and should therefore work harder than they would for money, but they don't necessarily take that attitude. They feel they're working for nothing, and doing a great kindness to us thereby. And if we seem ungrateful, they will work slowly and make mistakes. It will be best to rule them with a light touch." He caught Philip's eye and saw that the prior was suppressing a smile, as if he knew what misgivings underlay Tom's honeyed words. "A good point," Philip said. "If we handle them right, these people will feel happy and uplifted, and that will create a good atmosphere, which will make a positive impression on Bishop Henry." He looked around the assembled monks. "If there are no more questions, let's begin." Aliena had enjoyed a year of security and prosperity under the wing of Prior Philip. All her plans had worked. She and Richard had toured the countryside, buying fleeces from peasants all last spring and summer, selling to Philip every time they had a standard woolsack. They had ended the season with 5 pounds of silver. Father had died just a few days after they saw him, although Aliena did not find out until Christmas. She had located his grave after spending much hard-earned silver on bribes, in a pauper's cemetery in Winchester. She cried hard, not just for him, but for the life they had lived together, secure and carefree, the life that would never come back. In a way, she had said goodbye to him before he died. When she left the jail, she knew she would never see him again. In another way, he was still with her, for she was bound by the oath he had made her swear, and she was resigned to spending her life doing his will. During the winter, she and Richard lived in a small house up against the wall of Kingsbridge Priory. They had built a cart, buying the wheels from the Kingsbridge cartwright, and in the spring they had bought a young ox to pull it. The shearing season was now in full swing, and already they had made more than the cost of the ox and the new cart. Next year, perhaps she would employ a man to help her, and find Richard a place as a page in the household of a minor noble, so that he could begin his knightly training. But it was all dependent on Prior Philip. As an 18-year-old girl on her own, she was still considered fair game by every thief and many legitimate traders. She had tried to sell a sack of wool to merchants in Shiring and Gloucester, just to see what would happen, and both times she had been offered half price. There was never more than one merchant in a town, so they knew she had no alternative. Eventually she would have her own storehouse, and sell her entire stock to the Flemish buyers, but that time was a long way off. Meanwhile she was dependent on Philip, and Philip's position had suddenly become precarious. She was constantly alert to danger from outlaws and thieves, but it had come as a great shock to her when everything was going smoothly to have her whole livelihood threatened in such an unexpected way. Richard had not wanted to work on the cathedral building site on Whitsunday. He was nothing if not ungrateful, but Aliena had bullied him into agreeing, and the two of them walked the few yards to the priory close soon after sunrise. Almost the whole village had turned out, 30 or 40 men, some of them with their wives and children. Aliena was surprised, until she reflected that Prior Philip was their lord, and when your lord asked for volunteers, it was probably unwise to refuse. In the past year, she had gained a startling new perspective on the lives of ordinary people. Tom Builder was giving the villagers their assignments. Richard immediately went to speak to Tom's son, Alfred. They were almost the same age. Richard was 15 and Alfred about a year older, and they played football with the other boys in the village every Sunday. The little girl, Martha, was here too, but the woman, Ellen, and the funny-looking boy with red hair had disappeared. No one knew where. Aliena remembered when Tom's family had come to Earl's Castle. They had been destitute then. Like Aliena, they had been saved by Prior Philip. Aliena and Richard were given a shovel each and told to dig foundations. The ground was damp, but the sun was out, and it would soon dry the surface. Aliena began to dig energetically. Even with 50 people working, it took a long time to make the holes noticeably deeper. Richard rested on his shovel rather frequently. One time Aliena said, "If you ever want to be a knight, dig." But it made no difference. She was thinner and stronger than she had been a year ago, thanks to tramping the roads and lifting heavy loads of raw wool. But now she found that digging could still make her back ache. She was grateful when Prior Philip rang a bell and declared a break. Monks brought hot bread from the kitchen and served weak beer. The sun was growing stronger, and some of the men stripped to the waist. While they were resting, a group of strangers came through the gate. Aliena looked at them hopefully. There were just a handful of them, but perhaps they were the forerunners of a large crowd. They came over to the table where the bread and beer was being handed out, and Prior Philip welcomed them. "Where are you from?" he asked, as they gulped gratefully at their pots of beer. "From Horsted," one of them replied, wiping his mouth on his sleeve. That was promising. Horsted was a village of 200 or 300 people a few miles west of Kingsbridge. They might hope for another 100 volunteers from there, with luck. "And how many of you are coming in all?" Philip asked. The man looked surprised at the question. "Just us four," he replied. During the next hour, people trickled through the priory gate until by mid-morning there were 70 or 80 volunteers at work, including the villagers. Then the flow stopped altogether. It was not enough. Philip stood at the east end, watching Tom build a wall. He had already constructed the bases of 2 buttresses up to the level of the 3rd course of stones, and now he was building the wall between. It would probably never be finished, Philip thought despondently. The first thing Tom did when the labourers brought him a stone was to take out an iron instrument shaped like the letter L and use it to check that the edges of the stone were square. Then he would shovel a layer of mortar onto the wall, furrow the mortar with the point of his trowel, put the new stone on, and scrape off the surplus mortar. In placing the stone, he was guided by a taut string which was stretched between the 2 buttresses. Philip noticed that the stone was almost as smooth on the top and bottom, where the mortar was, as on the side that would show. This surprised him, and he asked Tom the reason. "A stone must never touch the ones above or below," Tom replied. "That's what the mortar's for." "Why must they not touch?"
"It causes cracks."
Tom stood upright to explain. "If you tread on a slate roof, your foot will go through it, but if you put a plank across the roof, you can walk on it without damaging the slates. The plank spreads the weight, and that's what mortar does." Philip had never thought of that. Building was an intriguing business, especially with someone like Tom, who was able to explain what he was doing. The roughest face of the stone was the back. Surely, Philip thought, that face would be visible from inside the church. Then he recalled that Tom was in fact building a double-skinned wall with a cavity between, so that the back of each stone would be hidden. When Tom had laid the stone on the bed of mortar, he picked up his level. This was an iron triangle with a leather thong attached to its apex and some markings on its base. The thong had a lead weight attached to it, so that it always hung straight down. He put the base of the instrument on the stone, and watched how the leather thong fell. If it hung to one side or the other of the center line, he would tap the stone with his hammer until it was exactly level. Then he would move the instrument until it straddled the join between the 2 adjacent stones, to check that the tops of the stones were exactly in line. Finally, he turned the instrument sideways on the stone to make sure it was not leaning one way or the other. Before picking up a new stone, he would snap the taut string to satisfy himself that the faces of the stones were in a straight line. Philip had not realized that it was so important that stone walls should be precisely straight and true. He lifted his gaze to the rest of the building site. It was so big that 80 men and women and a few children were lost in it. They were working away cheerfully in the sunshine, but they were so few that it seemed to him there was an air of futility about their efforts. He had originally hoped for 100 people, but now he saw that even that would not have been enough. Another little group came through the gateway and Philip forced himself to go to greet them with a smile. There was no need for them to know that their efforts would be wasted. They would gain forgiveness for their sins anyway. It was a large group, he saw, as he approached them. He counted 12, and then 2 more came in. Perhaps, after all, he would have 100 people by midday, when the bishop was expected. "God bless you all," he said to them. He was about to tell them where to start digging when he was interrupted by a loud shout. "Philip!" He frowned disapprovingly. The voice belonged to Brother Milius. Even Milius was supposed to call Philip Father in public. Philip looked in the direction from which the voice came. Milius was balancing on the priory wall in a somewhat undignified stance. In a calm but carrying voice, Philip said, "Brother Milius, get off the wall!" To his astonishment, Milius stayed there and shouted, "Come and look at this!" The new arrivals were getting a poor impression of monastic obedience, Philip thought, but he could not help wondering what it was that had got Milius so excited that he had forgotten all his manners. "Come here and tell me about it, Milius," he said in a voice he normally reserved for noisy novices. "You must look," Milius yelled. He'd better have a very good reason for this, Philip thought crossly. But since he did not want to give his closest colleague a telling off in front of all these strangers, he was obliged to smile and do as Milius asked. Feeling irritated to the point of anger, he walked across the muddy ground in front of the stable and jumped up onto the low wall. "What is the meaning of this behavior?" he hissed. "Just look," Milius said, pointing. Following his gesture, Philip looked out over the roofs of the village, past the river, to the road that followed the rise and fall of the land to the west. At first he could not believe his eyes. Between the fields of green crops, the undulating road was a solid mass of people, hundreds of them, all walking toward Kingsbridge. "What is it?" he said uncomprehendingly. "An army?" And then he realized that, of course, they were his volunteers. His heart leaped for joy. "Look at them!" he shouted. "There must be 500, 1,000 more!" "That's right," Milius said happily. "They came, after all. We're saved." Philip was too thrilled to remember why he was supposed to be angry with Milius. The mass of people filled the road all the way to the bridge, and the line wound through the village all the way to the priory gate. The people he had greeted were the head of a phalanx. They were pouring through the gate now, and milling about at the western end of the building site, waiting for someone to tell them what to do. "Hallelujah!" he yelled recklessly. It was not enough to rejoice. He had to use these people. He jumped down off the wall. "Come on," he shouted to Milius. "Call all the monks off laboring. We're going to need them as marshals. Tell the kitchener to bake all the bread he can, and roll out some more barrels of beer. We'll need more buckets and shovels. We must get all these people working before Bishop Henry arrives." For the next hour, Philip was frantically busy. At first, just to get people out of the way, he assigned 100 or more to the task of bringing materials up from the riverbank. As soon as Milius had assembled a supervisory group of monks, he began sending the volunteers down into the foundations. They soon ran out of shovels, barrels, and buckets. Philip ordered all the cooking pots brought from the kitchen, and set some of the volunteers to making rough timber boxes and basketwork platters for carrying earth. There were not enough ladders or lifting devices, so they made a long slope at one end of the largest foundation hole, so that people could walk into and out of it. He realized he had not given sufficient thought to the question of where he was going to put the vast quantity of earth that was coming out of the foundations. Now it was too late to mull it over. He made a snap decision, and ordered the earth dumped on a patch of rocky ground near the river. Perhaps it might become cultivable. While he was giving that order, Bernard Kitchener came to him in a panic, saying he had only catered for 200 people at most, and there seemed to be at least 1,000 here. "Build a fire in the kitchen courtyard, and make soup in an iron bath," Philip said. "Water the beer. Use all the stores. Get some of the villagers to prepare food on their own hearths. Improvise." He turned away from the kitchener and resumed organizing laborers.
He was still giving orders when someone tapped him on the shoulder and said in French, "Prior Philippe, may I have your attention for a moment?" It was Dean Baldwin, Waller and Bigod's associate. Philippe turned around and saw the entire visiting party, all on horseback and gorgeously dressed, gazing in astonishment at the scene around them. There was Bishop Henry, a short, thick-set man with a pugnacious look about him, his monkish haircut contrasting strangely with his embroidered scarlet coat. Beside him was Bishop Walleran, dressed in black, as always, his dismay not quite concealed by his habitual look of frozen disdain. There was fat Percy Hamley, his strapping son William, and his hideous wife Regan. Percy and William were looking bemused, but Regan understood exactly what Philip had done, and she was furious. Philip returned his attention to Bishop Henry, and found to his surprise that the bishop was favouring him with a look of intense interest. Philip returned his gaze frankly. Bishop Henry's expression showed surprise, curiosity, and a kind of amused respect. After a moment, Philip approached the bishop, held his horse's head, and kissed the beringed hand that Henry proffered. Henry dismounted with a smooth, agile movement, and the rest of his party followed suit. Philip called a couple of monks to stable the horses. Henry was the same age as Philip, approximately, but his florid complexion and well-covered frame made him look older. "Well, Father Philip," he said, "I came to verify reports that you were not capable of getting a new cathedral built here at Kingsbridge." He paused, looked around at the hundreds of workers, then returned his gaze to Philip. "It seems I was misinformed." Philip's heart missed a beat. Henry could hardly make it plainer. Philip had won. Philip turned to Bishop Walleran. Walleran's face was a mask of suppressed fury. He knew he had been defeated again. Philip knelt, bowing his head to hide the look of triumphant delight on his face, and kissed Walleran's hand. Tom was enjoying building the wall. It was so long since he had done this that he had forgotten the deep tranquillity that came from laying one stone upon another, in perfect straight lines, and watching the structure grow. When the volunteers started to arrive by the hundred and he realized that Philip's scheme was going to work, he enjoyed it all the more. These stones would be part of Tom's cathedral, and this wall, that was now only a foot high, would eventually reach for the sky. Tom felt he was at the beginning of the rest of his life. He knew when Bishop Henry arrived, like a stone dropped into a pond, the bishop sent a ripple through the mass of labourers, as people stopped work for a moment to look up at the richly dressed figures, picking their dainty way through the mud. Tom continued to lay stones. The bishop must be bowled over by the sight of 1,000 volunteers cheerfully and enthusiastically labouring to build their new cathedral. Now Tom needed to make an equally good impression. He was never at ease with well-dressed people, but he needed to appear competent and wise, calm and self-assured, the kind of man to whom you would gratefully entrust the worrisome complexities of a vast and costly building project. He kept a lookout for the visitors and put down his trowel as the party approached him. Prior Philip led Bishop Henry up to Tom, and Tom knelt and kissed the bishop's hand. Philip said, "Tom is our builder, sent to us by God on the day the old church burned down." Tom knelt again to Bishop Walleran, then looked at the rest of the party. He reminded himself that he was the master builder, and should not be overly subservient. He recognized Percy Hamley, for whom he had once built half a house. "My Lord Percy," he said with a small bow. He spotted Percy's hideous wife, "My Lady Regan." Then his eye fell on the sun. He remembered how William had almost run Martha down on his great war horse, and how William had tried to buy Ellen in the forest. That young man was a nasty piece of work. But Tom made his face a polite mask. "And young Lord William, greetings." Bishop Henry was looking keenly at Tom. "Have you drawn your plans, Tom Builder?"
"Yes, my Lord Bishop. Would you like to see them?"
"Most certainly."
"Perhaps you will step this way."
Henry nodded, and Tom led the way to his shed, a few yards away. He stepped inside the little wooden building and brought out the ground plan, drawn in plaster on a large wooden frame 4 feet long. He leaned it against the wall of the shed and stepped back. This was a delicate moment. Most people could not read a plan, but bishops and lords hated to admit it, so it was necessary to explain the concept to them in a way that did not reveal their ignorance to the rest of the world. Some bishops did understand it, of course, and then they were insulted when a mere builder presumed to instruct them. Nervously, Tom pointed at the plan and said, "This is the wall I'm building." "Yes, the eastern facade, obviously," said Henry. That answered the question. He could read a plan perfectly well. "Why aren't the transepts aisled?"
"For economy," Tom answered promptly.
"However, we won't start building them for another 5 years, and if the monastery continues to prosper as it has done in the first year under Prior Philip, it may well be that by then we will be able to afford aisled transepts." He had praised Philip and answered the question at the same time, and he felt rather clever. Henry nodded approval. "Sensible to plan modestly and leave room for expansion. Show me the elevation." Tom got out the elevation. He made no comment on it now that he knew Henry was able to understand what he was looking at. This was confirmed when Henry said, "The proportions are pleasing."
"Thank you," said Tom.
The bishop seemed pleased with everything. Tom added, "It's a modest cathedral, but it will be lighter and more beautiful than the old one."
"And how long will it take to complete?"
15 years, if the work is uninterrupted.
"Which it never is. However, can you show us what it will look like? I mean, to someone standing outside."
Tom understood him. "You want to see a sketch?"
"Yes."
"Certainly." Tom returned to his wall with the bishop's party in tow. He knelt over his mortarboard and spread the mortar in a uniform layer, smoothing the surface. Then, with the point of his trowel, he drew a sketch of the west end of the church in the mortar. He knew he was good at this. The bishop, his party, and all the monks and volunteer workers nearby watched in fascination. Drawing always seemed a miracle to people who could not do it. In a few moments Tom had created a line drawing of the west facade, with its three arched doorways, its big window, and its flanking turrets. It was a simple trick, but it never failed to impress.
"Remarkable," said Bishop Henry when the drawing was done. "May God's blessing be added to your skill."
Tom smiled. That amounted to a powerful endorsement of his appointment. Prior Philip said, "My Lord Bishop, will you take some refreshment before you conduct the service?"
"Gladly."
Tom was relieved. His test was over and he had passed it.
"Perhaps you would step into the prior's house just across here," Philip said to the bishop.
The party began to move off. Philip squeezed Tom's arm and said in a murmur of restrained jubilation, "We've done it." Tom breathed a sigh of relief as the dignitaries left him. He felt pleased and proud. "Yes," he thought, "we've done it." Bishop Henry was more than impressed. He was flabbergasted, despite his composure. Obviously, Walleran had primed him to expect a scene of lethargy and inactivity, so the reality had been even more striking. In the end, Walleran's malice had worked against him and heightened the triumph of Philip and Tom. Just as he was basking in the glow of an honest victory, he heard a familiar voice.
"Hello, Tom Builder."
He turned around and saw Ellen. It was Tom's turn to be flabbergasted. The cathedral crisis had so filled his mind that he had not thought about her all day. He gazed at her happily. She looked just the same as the day she had walked away, slender, brown-skinned, with dark hair that moved like waves on a beach, and those deep-set, luminous, golden eyes. She smiled at him with that full-lipped mouth that always made him think of kissing. He was seized by an urge to take her in his arms, but he fought it down. With some difficulty he managed to say, "Hello, Ellen." A young man beside her said, "Hello, Tom." Tom looked at him curiously. Ellen said, "Don't you remember Jack?"
"Jack?" he said, startled.
The lad had changed. He was a little taller than his mother now, and he had the bony physique that made grandmother say that a boy had outgrown his strength. He still had bright red hair, white skin, and blue eyes, but his features had resolved into more attractive proportions, and one day he might even be handsome. Tom looked back at Ellen. For a moment he just enjoyed staring at her. He wanted to say, "I've missed you. I can't tell you how much I've missed you." And he almost did. But then he lost his nerve, and instead he said, "Well, where have you been?" "We've been living where we always lived, in the forest," she said. "And what made you come back today of all days?" "We heard about the appeal for volunteers, and we were curious to know how you were getting along. And I haven't forgotten that I promised to come back one day."
"I'm so glad you did," Tom said. "I've been longing to see you."
She looked guarded. "Oh?" This was the moment for which he had been waiting and planning for a year, and now that it had come, he was scared. Until now he had been able to live in hope, but if she turned him down today, he would know he had lost her forever. He was frightened to begin. The silence dragged out. He took a deep breath.
"Listen," he said, "I want you to come back to me.
Now, please don't say anything until you've heard what I have to say. Please."
"All right," she said neutrally.
"Philip is a very good prior. The monastery is getting wealthier all the time, thanks to his good management. My job here is secure. We won't have to tramp the roads again, ever, I promise."
"It wasn't that.
I know. But I want to tell you everything."
"All right.
I've built a house in the village, with 2 rooms and a chimney, and I can make it bigger. We wouldn't have to live in the priory.
But Philip owns the village.
Philip is indebted to me right now." Tom waved an arm to indicate the scene all around. "He knows he couldn't have done this without me. If I ask him to forgive you for what you did, and to regard your year of exile as penance enough, he'll agree. He couldn't deny me that, today of all days."
"What about the boys?" she said. "Am I supposed to watch Alfred spill Jack's blood every time he feels irritable?"
"I think I've got the answer to that, really," Tom said. "Alfred is a mason now. I'll take Jack as my apprentice. That way Alfred won't be resentful of Jack's idleness, and you can teach Alfred to read and write so that the 2 boys will be equal. Both working men, both literate."
"You've thought about this a lot, haven't you?" she said.
"Yes." He waited for her reaction. He was no good at being persuasive. All he could do was set out the situation. If only he could have drawn her a sketch. He felt he had dealt with every possible objection. She must agree now. But still she hesitated.
"I'm not sure," she said.
His self-control broke.
"Oh, Ellen, don't say that."
He was afraid of crying in front of all these people, and he was so choked up that he could hardly speak.
"I love you so much. Please don't go away again," he begged. "The only thing that's kept me going is the hope that you'd come back. I just can't bear to live without you. Don't close the gates of paradise. Can't you see that I love you with all my heart?"
Her manner changed instantly.
"Why didn't you say so then?" she whispered,
and she came to him. He wrapped his arms around her.
"I love you too, you silly fool," she said.
He felt weak with joy.
"She does love me, she does," he thought.
He hugged her hard. Then he looked at her face. "Will you marry me, Ellen?" There were tears in her eyes, but she was smiling too.
"Yes, Tom, I'll marry you," she said.
She lifted her face. He pulled her to him and kissed her mouth. He had dreamed of this for a year. He closed his eyes and concentrated on the delightful touch of her full lips on his. Her mouth was slightly open and her lips were moist. The kiss was so delicious that for a moment he forgot himself. Then someone nearby said, "Don't swallow her, man!" He pulled away from her and said, "We're in a church."
"I don't care,"
she said merrily, and she kissed him again. Prior Philip had outwitted them again, William thought bitterly as he sat in the prior's house, drinking Philip's watery wine and eating sweetmeats from the priory kitchen. It had taken William a while to appreciate the brilliance and completeness of Philip's victory. There had been nothing wrong with Bishop Walleran's original assessment of the situation. It was true that Philip was short of money and would have great difficulty building a cathedral at Kingsbridge. But despite that, the wily monk had made dogged progress, hired a master builder, started the building, and then, out of nothing, conjured a vast workforce to bamboozle Bishop Henry. and Henry had been duly impressed, all the more so because Walleran had painted such a bleak picture in advance. That damned monk knew he had won, too. He could not keep the triumphant smile off his face. Now he was deep in conversation with Bishop Henry, talking animatedly about breeds of sheep and the price of wool, and Henry was listening carefully, almost respectfully, meanwhile rudely ignoring William's mother and father, who were far more important than a mere prior. Philip was going to regret this day. Nobody was allowed to best the Hamleys and get away with it. They had not reached the position they enjoyed today by allowing monks to get the better of them. Bartholomew of Shiring had insulted them and had died in a traitor's jail. Philip would fare no better. Tom Builder was another man who was going to regret crossing the Hamleys. William had not forgotten how Tom had defied him at Durstead, holding his horse's head and forcing him to pay the workmen. Today Tom had disrespectfully called him young Lord William. He was obviously hand in glove with Philip now, building cathedrals, not manor houses. He would learn that it was better to take your chances with the Hamleys than to join forces with their enemies. William sat quietly fuming until Bishop Henry got to his feet and said he was ready to hold the service. Prior Philip gestured to a novice who went running from the room, and a few moments later a bell began to ring. They all left the house, Bishop Henry first, Bishop Walleran second, then Prior Philip, then the lay people. All the monks were waiting outside, and they fell into line behind Philip, forming a procession. The Hamleys had to bring up the rear. The volunteers filled the entire western half of the priory close, sitting on walls and roofs. Henry mounted a platform in the middle of the building site. The monks formed up in rows behind him, where the choir of the new cathedral would be. The Hamleys and the other lay members of the bishop's entourage made their way to what would become the nave. As they took their places, William saw Aliena. She looked very different. She wore rough, cheap clothing and wooden clogs, and the mass of curls that framed her head was damp with sweat. But it was definitely Aliena, and she was still so beautiful that his throat went dry, and he stared at her, unable to tear his gaze away, while the service began and the priory close filled with the sound of a thousand voices saying, "The Our Father." She seemed to feel his intense look, for she appeared troubled, shifting from foot to foot, and then glancing around as if searching. Finally she met his eyes. An expression of horror and fear came over her face, and she shrank back, although she was already 10 yards or more away and separated from him by dozens of people. Her fear made her all the more desirable to him, and he felt his body respond in a way it had not done for a year. His lust for her was mingled with resentment because of the spell she had cast over him. She flushed and dropped her gaze as if she were ashamed. She spoke briefly to a boy next to her. That was the brother, of course, William thought, recalling the face in a flash of erotic memory, and then she turned away and disappeared into the crowd. William felt let down. He was tempted to follow her, but of course he could not in the middle of a service, in front of his parents, 2 bishops, 40 monks, and 1,000 worshippers. So he turned back to face the front, disappointed. He had lost his chance to find out where she lived. Although she had gone, she still filled his mind. He wondered if it was a sin to have an erection in church. He noticed that Father was looking agitated. "Look," he was saying to Mother, "look at that woman." At first William thought Father must be talking about Aliena, but she was nowhere in sight, and when he followed his father's stare, he saw a woman nearer to 30 years of age, not as voluptuous as Aliena, but with an agile, untamed look that made her interesting. She was standing some distance away with Tom, the master builder, and William thought it was probably the builder's wife, the woman he had tried to buy in the forest one day a year or so ago. But why would his father know her? "Is it her?" Father said. The woman turned her head almost as if she had heard them, and looked straight at them, and William saw again her pale, penetrating golden eyes. "It is her, by God," Mother hissed. The woman's stare shook Father. His red face paled and his hands trembled. "Jesus Christ preserve us," he said. "I thought she was dead." And William thought, "Now what the devil is that all about?" Jack had been dreading this. For a whole year he had known that his mother missed Tom Builder. She was less even-tempered than she used to be. She often had a dreamy, faraway look, and in the night she sometimes made the panting noises, as if she were dreaming or imagining that she was making love to Tom. Jack had known all along that she would come back, and now she had agreed to stay. He hated the idea. The two of them had always been happy together. He loved his mother, and his mother loved him, and there was no one else to interfere. Life in the forest was somewhat uninteresting, it was true. He had missed the fascination of the crowds and the cities he had seen in his brief sojourn with Tom's family. He missed Martha. Oddly enough, he had relieved the boredom of the forest by daydreaming about the girl he thought of as the princess, although he knew her name was Aliena. And he would be interested to work with Tom and find out how buildings were constructed. But he would no longer be free. People would tell him what to do. He would have to work, whether he wanted to or not, and he would have to share his mother with the rest of the world. As he sat on the wall near the priory gate, ruminating disconsolately, he was astonished to see the princess. He blinked. She was pushing her way through the crowd, heading for the gate, looking distressed. She was even more beautiful than he remembered. In those days she had had a rounded, voluptuous, girlish body dressed in costly clothes. Now she looked thinner and more like a woman than a girl. The sweat-soaked linen shift she wore clung to her body, showing her full breasts and the ribs beneath, a flat belly, narrow hips, and long legs. Her face was smeared with mud, and her massed curls were untidy. She was upset about something, frightened and distressed, but the emotion only made her face more radiant. Jack was captivated by the sight of her. He felt a peculiar stirring in his loins that he had never experienced before. He followed her. There was no conscious decision. One moment he was sitting on the wall, gaping at her, and the next he was hurrying through the gate behind her. He caught up with her on the street outside. She had a musky scent, as though she had been working hard. He remembered that she used to smell of flowers. "Is anything wrong?" he said. "No, nothing's wrong," she said curtly, and she quickened her step. Jack kept pace with her. "You don't remember me. Last time we met, you explained to me how babies were conceived." "Oh, shut up and go away," she shouted. He stopped and let her walk on. He felt disappointed. Obviously, he had said the wrong thing. She had treated him like an irritating child. He was 13 years old, but that probably seemed like childhood to her, from the lofty heights of 18 or so years. He saw her go up to a house, take out a key that hung from a thong around her neck, and unlock the door. She lived right here. That made everything different. Suddenly the prospect of leaving the forest and living in Kingsbridge did not seem so bad. He would see the princess every day. That would compensate for a lot. He stayed where he was, watching the door, but she did not reemerge. It was an odd thing to do, to stand in a street in the hope of seeing someone who hardly knew him, but he did not want to move. He was seething inside with a new emotion. Nothing seemed very important anymore except the princess. He was single-minded about her. He was enchanted. He was possessed. He was in love. Part 3. 1140 to 1142. Chapter 8. The whore William picked was not very pretty, but she had big breasts, and her mass of curly hair appealed to him. She sauntered over to him, swaying her hips, and he saw that she was a little older than he had thought, maybe 25 or 30, and while her mouth smiled innocently, her eyes were hard and calculating. Walter chose next. He selected a small, vulnerable-looking girl with a boyish, flat-chested figure. When William and Walter had made their selection, the other four knights moved in. William had brought them to the whorehouse because they needed some kind of release. They had not had a battle for months, and they were becoming discontented and quarrelsome. The civil war that had broken out a year ago, between King Stephen and his rival Maud, the so-called Empress, was now in a lull. William and his men had followed Stephen all over southwest England. His strategy was energetic but erratic. He would attack one of Maud's strongholds with tremendous enthusiasm, but if he did not win an early victory, he swiftly tired of the siege and would move on. The military leader of the rebels was not Maud herself, but her half-brother Robert, Earl of Gloucester, and so far Stephen had failed to force him into a confrontation. It was an indecisive war, with much movement and little actual fighting, and so the men were restless. The whorehouse was divided by screens into small rooms, each with a straw mattress. William and his knights took their chosen women behind the screens. William's whore adjusted the screen for privacy, then pulled down the top of her shift, exposing her breasts. They were big, as William had seen, but they had the large nipples and visible veins of a woman who has suckled children, and William was a little disappointed. Nevertheless, he pulled her to him and took her breasts in his hands, squeezing them and pinching the nipples.
"Gently," she said in a tone of mild protest.
She put her arms around him and pulled his hips forward, rubbing herself against him. After a few moments, she pushed her hand between their bodies and felt for his groin. He muttered a curse. His body was not responding.
"Don't worry," she murmured.
Her condescending tone angered him, but he said nothing as she disengaged herself from his embrace, knelt down, lifted the front of his tunic, and went to work with her mouth. At first, the sensation pleased him, and he thought everything was going to be all right. But after the initial surge, he lost interest again. He watched her face, as that sometimes inflamed him, but now he was only reminded of how unimpressive he appeared. He began to feel angry, and that made him shrivel even more. She stopped and said,
"Try to relax."
When she started again, she sucked so hard that she hurt him. He pulled away, and her teeth scraped his sensitive skin, making him cry out. He struck her backhanded across the face. She gasped and fell sideways.
"Clumsy bitch," he snarled.
She lay on the mattress at his feet, looking up at him fearfully. He threw a random kick at her, more in irritation than malice. It caught her in the belly. It was harder than he had really intended, and she doubled up in pain. He realized that his body was responding at last. He knelt down, rolled her onto her back, and straddled her. She stared up at him with pain and fear in her eyes. He pulled up the skirt of her dress until it was around her waist. The hair between her legs was thick and curly. He liked that. He fondled himself as he looked at her body. He was not quite stiff enough. The fear was going from her eyes. It occurred to him that she could be deliberately putting him off, trying to deflate his desires so that she would not have to service him. The thought infuriated him. He made a fist and punched her face hard. She screamed and tried to get out from under him. He rested his weight on her, pinning her down, but she continued to struggle and yell. Now he was fully erect. He tried to force her thighs apart, but she resisted him. The screen was jerked aside, and Walter came in wearing only his boots and undershirt, with his prick sticking out in front of him like a flagpole. Two more knights came in behind him, Ugly Gervaise and Hugh Axe. "Hold it down for me, lads," William said to them. The three knights knelt down around the whore and held her still. William positioned himself to enter her, then paused, enjoying the anticipation. Walter said, "What happened, Lord?"
"Changed her mind when she saw the size of it," William said with a grin.
They all roared with laughter. William penetrated her. He liked it when there were people watching. He started to move in and out. Walter said, "You interrupted me just as I was getting mine in." William could see that Walter had not yet been satisfied.
"Stick it in this one's mouth," he said.
"She likes that.
I'll give it a try."
Walter changed his position and grabbed the woman by the hair, lifting her head. By now she was frightened enough to do anything, and she cooperated readily. Gervaise and Hugh were no longer needed to hold her down, but they stayed and watched. They looked fascinated. They had probably never seen a woman done by two men at the same time. William had never seen it either. There was something curiously exciting about it. Walter seemed to feel the same, for after just a few moments he began to breathe heavily and move convulsively, and then he came. Watching him, William did the same a second or two later. After a moment, they got to their feet. William still felt excited.
"Why don't you two do her?" he said to Gervaise and Hugh. He liked the idea of watching a repeat performance. However, they were not keen.
"I've got a little doll in waiting," said Hugh, and Gervaise said, "Me too."
The whore stood up and rearranged her dress. Her face was unreadable. William said to her, "That wasn't so bad, was it?" She stood in front of him and stared at him for a moment. Then she pursed her lips and spat. He felt his face covered with a warm, sticky fluid. She had retained Walter's semen in her mouth. The stuff blurred his vision. Angry, he raised a hand to strike her, but she ducked out between the screens. Walter and the other knights burst out laughing. William did not think it was funny, but he could not chase after the girl with semen all over his face, and he realized that the only way to retain his dignity was to pretend not to care, so he laughed too. Ugly Gervaise said, "Well, Lord, I hope you don't have Walter's baby now," and they roared. Even William thought that was funny. They all walked out of the little booth together, leaning on one another and wiping their eyes. The other girls were staring at them, looking anxious. They had heard William's horse scream and were afraid of trouble. One or two customers peeped out curiously from the other booths. Walter said, "First time I ever saw that stuff spurt out of a girl," and they started laughing again. One of William's squires was standing by the door, looking anxious. He was only a lad, and he had probably never been inside a brothel before. He smiled nervously, not sure whether he was entitled to join in the hilarity. William said to him, "What are you doing here, you po-faced idiot?"
"There's a message come for you, Lord,"
the squire said. "Well, don't waste time. Tell me what it is."
"I'm very sorry, Lord," said the boy.
He looked so frightened that William thought he was going to turn around and run out of the house.
"What are you sorry for, you turd?" William roared. "Give me the message."
"Your father's dead, Lord,"
the boy blurted out, and he burst into tears. William stared, dumbstruck.
"Dead," he thought. "Dead."
"But he's in perfectly good health," he shouted stupidly. It was true that father was not able to fight on the battlefield anymore, but that was not surprising in a man almost 50 years old. The squire continued to cry. William recalled the way father had looked last time he saw him, stout, red-faced, hearty and choleric, as full of life as a man could be, and that was only— He realized with a small shock that it was nearly a year since he had seen his father.
"What happened?" he said to the squire. "What happened to him?"
"He had a seizure, Lord,"
the squire sobbed. "A seizure." The news began to sink in. Father was dead. That big, strong, blustering, irascible man was lying helpless and cold on a stone slab somewhere. "I'll have to go home," William said suddenly. Walter said gently, "You must first ask the king to release you."
"Yes, that's right," William said vaguely. "I must ask permission."
His mind was in a turmoil. "Shall I tip the brothel keeper?" said Walter.
"Yes."
William handed Walter his purse. Someone put William's cloak over his shoulders. Walter murmured something to the woman who ran the whorehouse and gave her some money. Hugh Axe opened the door for William. They all went out. They walked through the streets of the small town in silence. William felt peculiarly detached, as if he were watching everything from above. He could not take in the fact that his father no longer existed. As they approached headquarters, he tried to pull himself together. King Stephen was holding court in the church, for there was no castle or guild hall here. It was a small, simple stone church, with its inside walls painted bright red, blue, and orange. A fire had been lit in the middle of the floor, and the handsome, tawny-haired king sat near it on a wooden throne, with his legs stretched out before him in his usual relaxed position. He wore soldier's clothes, high boots, and a leather tunic, but he had a crown instead of a helmet. William and Walter pushed through the crowd of petitioners near the church door, nodded at the guards who were keeping the general public back, and strode into the inner circle. Stephen was talking to a newly arrived earl, but he noticed William and broke off immediately.
"William, my friend, you've heard."
William bowed.
My lord king.
Stephen stood up. I mourn with you, he said. He put his arms around William and held him for a moment before releasing him. His sympathy brought the first tears to William's eyes.
I must ask you for leave to go home, he said.
Granted willingly, though not gladly, said the king. We'll miss your strong right arm.
Thank you, lord. I also grant you custody of the earldom of Shiring, and all the revenues from it, until the question of the succession is decided. Go home, and bury your father, and come back to us as soon as you can.
William bowed again and withdrew. The king resumed his conversation. Courtiers gathered around William to commiserate. As he accepted their condolences, the significance of what the king had said hit him. He had given William custody of the earldom until the question of the succession is decided. What question? William was the only child of his father. How could there be a question? He looked at the faces around him, and his eye lit upon a young priest, who was one of the more knowledgeable of the king's clerics. He drew the priest to him and said quietly, What the devil did he mean about the question of the succession, Joseph?
There's another claimant to the earldom, Joseph replied.
Another claimant? William repeated in astonishment. He had no half-brothers, illegitimate brothers, cousins. Who is it? Joseph pointed to a figure standing with his back to them. He was with the new arrivals. He was wearing the clothing of a squire.
But he's not even a knight!
William said loudly. My father was the Earl of Shiring. The squire heard him and turned around.
My father was also the Earl of Shiring.
At first William did not recognize him. He saw a handsome, broad-shouldered young man of about 18 years, well-dressed for a squire, and carrying a fine sword. There was confidence and even arrogance in the way he stood. Most striking of all, he gazed at William with a look of such pure hatred that William shrank back. The face was very familiar, but changed. Still William could not place it. Then he saw that there was an angry scar on the squire's right ear where the earlobe had been cut off. In a vivid flash of memory he saw a small piece of white flesh fall onto the heaving chest of a terrified virgin, and heard a boy scream in pain. This was Richard, the son of the traitor Bartholomew, the brother of Aliena. The little boy, who had been forced to watch while two men raped his sister, had grown into a formidable man with the light of vengeance in his light blue eyes. William was suddenly terribly afraid.
You remember, don't you?
Richard said in a light drawl that did not quite mask the cold fury underneath. William nodded.
I remember.
So do I,
William Hamley, said Richard.
So do I.
William sat in the big chair at the head of the table, where his father used to sit. He had always known he would occupy this seat one day. He had imagined he would feel immensely powerful when he did so, but in reality he was a little frightened. He was afraid that people would say he was not the man his father had been, and that they would disrespect him. His mother sat on his right. He had often watched her when his father was in this chair, and observed the way she played on father's fears and weaknesses to get her own way. He was determined not to let her do the same to him. On his left sat Arthur, a mild-mannered, grey-headed man who had been Earl Bartholomew's reeve. After becoming Earl, father had hired Arthur because Arthur had a good knowledge of the estate. William had always been dubious about that reasoning. Other people's servants sometimes clung to the ways of their former employer.
King Stephen can't possibly make Richard the Earl, mother was saying angrily. He's just a squire.
I don't understand how he even managed that, William said irritably. I thought they had been left penniless. But he had fine clothes and a good sword. Where did he get the money?
He set himself up as a wool merchant, mother said.
He's got all the money he needs, or rather his sister has. I hear Aliena runs the business. Aliena. So she was behind this. William had never quite forgotten her, but she had not preyed on his mind so much after the war broke out, until he had met Richard. Since then she had been in his thoughts continually, as fresh and beautiful, as vulnerable and desirable as ever. He hated her for the hold she had over him.
So Aliena is rich now, he said with an affectation of detachment. Yes, but you've been fighting for the king for a year. He cannot refuse you your inheritance.
Richard has fought bravely too, apparently, William said. I made some inquiries. Worse still, his courage has come to the notice of the king.
Mother's expression changed from angry scorn to thoughtfulness.
So he really has a chance.
I fear so.
Right. We must fight him off.
Automatically, William said, how? He had resolved not to let his mother take charge, but now he had done it. You must go back to the king with a bigger force of knights, new weapons and better horses, and plenty of squires and men-at-arms.
William would have liked to disagree with her, but he knew she was right.
In the end, the king would probably give the earldom to the man who promised to be the most effective supporter, regardless of the rights and wrongs of the case.
That's not all, Mother went on. You must take care to look and act like an earl. That way the king will start to think of the appointment as a foregone conclusion.
Despite himself, William was intrigued. How should an earl look and act?
Speak your mind more. Have an opinion about everything. How the king should prosecute the war. The best tactics for each battle. The political situation in the north. And especially this. The abilities and loyalty of other earls. Talk to one man about another. Tell the Earl of Huntingdon that the Count of Warren is a great fighter. Tell the Bishop of Ely that you don't trust the Sheriff of Lincoln.
People will say to the king, William of Shiring is in the Count of Warren's faction, or William of Shiring and his followers are against the Sheriff of Lincoln. If you appear powerful, the king will feel comfortable about giving you more power.
William had little faith in such subtlety. I think the size of my army will count for more, he said.
He turned to the reeve. How much is there in my treasury, Arthur?
Nothing, lord, said Arthur.
What the devil are you talking about? Said William harshly. There must be something. How much is it?
Arthur had a slightly superior air, as if he had nothing to fear from William.
Lord, there's no money at all in the treasury.
William wanted to strangle him. This is the earldom of Shiring, he said, loud enough to make the knights and castle officials, farther down the table, look up.
There must be money!
Money comes in all the time, Lord, of course, Arthur said smoothly, but it goes out again, especially in wartime.
William studied the pale, clean-shaven face. Arthur was far too complacent.
Was he honest? There was no way of telling. William wished for eyes that could see into a man's heart.
Mother knew what William was thinking.
Arthur is honest, she said, not caring that the man was right there. He's old and lazy and set in his ways, but he's honest.
William was stricken. He had only just sat in the chair, and already his power was shriveling as if by magic. He felt cursed. There seemed to be a law that William would always be a boy among men, no matter how old he grew.
Weakly, he said, How has this happened?
Mother said, Your father was ill for the best part of a year before he died. I could see he was letting things slip, but I couldn't get him to do anything about it.
It was news to William that his mother was not omnipotent. He had never before known her unable to get her way. He turned to Arthur.
We have some of the best farmland in the kingdom here. How can we be penniless?
Some of the farms are in trouble, and several tenants are in arrears with their rents.
But why?
One reason I hear frequently is that the young men won't work on the land, but leave for the towns.
Then we must stop them.
Arthur shrugged. Once a serf has lived in a town for a year, he becomes a free man.
It's the law.
And what about the tenants who haven't paid? What have you done to them?
What can one do? Said Arthur. If we take away their livelihood, they'll never be able to pay. So we must be patient and hope for a good harvest, which will enable them to catch up.
Arthur was altogether too cheerful about his inability to solve any of these problems, William thought angrily. But he reined in his temper for the moment. Well, if all the young men are going to the towns, what about our rents from house property in Shiring? That should have brought in some cash.
Oddly enough, it hasn't, said Arthur. There are a lot of empty houses in Shiring. The young men must be going elsewhere.
Or people are lying.